Welcome to Perspectives on Prevention, the podcast series from the Prevention and Early Intervention Network, where we talk with people about intervening early and preventing difficulties arising for children, families, and communities. This episode of Perspectives on Prevention, I'm really excited to be talking to Dimpna Kanan, who is the manager of an organisation in England called Our Time. And I know that people are going to be really interested to hear what she has to say about working with families that are impacted by mental health issues. Dimpna is originally from Dublin and has studied psychology and philosophy in Dublin, but she's been over in London for quite a long time and studied with the Tavistock in psychoanalytic studies, and she's held positions in a number of academic institutions and also worked as an organisational consultant. So Dimpna, let's just make a start. I had the very happy accident of stumbling across Joe Wicks's documentary recently, and that's how I came to hear about the Our Time charity. So just tell us a bit about the work that you do and its purpose and objectives.
Yeah, sure. So Our Time was set up in 2012 to address the needs of children who have a parent with a mental illness. And it was set up by a psychiatrist who saw adults that had, he knew they had children, and he wondered how those children were supported and what happened to them if he admitted one of those adult patients to hospital, or, and what was the long-term impact on the children of those parents. And he found that there was very little research and there was almost no support for the children. So he set about finding out from them what their experiences were, what life was like, what were the challenges, and what support they had existing and what support they felt they needed. So that was quite a big thing to do, in that most of those families said nobody ever asked them before what their life was like, what their challenges were, or what they needed. So he began to interview those families, particularly the children and young people, and start to work with them to build interventions that would meet their needs. And he found that the needs were not so much medical or clinical, but sort of psychological and social support. So he developed what we now have is the Kids Time Workshop. And the Kids Time Workshop is a model where families in local areas come together who share the same experience. And they do that once a month after school for 2.5 hours, but usually between 5 and 7:30. And it's a place where the parents can meet other parents. So the whole families come to these workshops. And in any one workshop, you would have between 10 and 15 families in the community. And so the families come together once a month and the parents can talk with each other about the challenges of being a parent and form a sort of peer-led community where they help one another out and develop relationships outside of the workshop, to challenge the kind of social isolation that these families normally experience. Because they're ashamed of their illness, they don't tend to bring friends home or be integrated into the community. So there's a very large community building aspect to the workshops. And because they're locally based, then we link them into other services and we try and build the trust that those families have lost with other services, and connect them to one another and connect them to the outside world. While the parents are working together in a peer community, the children are off with a drama therapist and they de-stress. Mainly, they play. It's an opportunity for them to be children again and to relinquish the burden of responsibility that they feel towards their parents. So it's kind of, they say, one time in the month when I don't have to worry about my mum or dad. And they also, the dramatist puts together a script using ideas and thoughts from the group themselves on that particular evening. And they create a little playlet around about 3 to 5 minutes and they video it. And that is an enormous achievement. And it's amazing to see those little plays. They're often about difficult topics like fear of suicide. They often are about medication and diagnosis, where the children have an opportunity to ask the questions, that they have never been able to ask before. And the idea is that it doesn't stigmatize any one family. So they're not asked to reveal their family situations, but they're asked what's on their mind and what are their questions, what are their worries on that particular day. So it varies from month to month what they're concerned about. And then there's a psychoeducational part of it where we put mental illness right out there on the table and talk about it from the very beginning, because most people avoid the topic and most of the parents have very little language to describe their situation and their feelings and their struggles. They usually only have medical language, and that's not helpful to the children. It doesn't explain anything. So what we do is we have a theme for the month, and that theme comes from the group themselves. So what do you want to talk about this evening? So that brings me on to how the teams are run. The teams are comprised of three professionals from the local area: a mental health lead, who's usually a family therapist, a CAMHS worker, could be a psychiatrist, psychologist. It has to be somebody who's not frightened of mental illness and who's able to explain it in ordinary language, age appropriate, because if you think about the groups, they have children between 5 and 18, all in the same room. So it's a challenge for the mental health lead to be that person, to explain symptoms, to explain diagnosis names, you know, what is bipolar, what is schizophrenia. And they can, you know, plan for those sessions, but they're not lectures, they're conversations. And the whole idea is that the workshop is generated from the content is generated from the families. It's not preset. And that makes it very different to other interventions where, if you like, the professionals are in charge. So the mental health lead has experience of working with serious mental health issues. And then there's a coordinator who's the project manager, and they're responsible for logistics and referrals and all the administration of the workshop. And then the third person is the dramatist. They can usually come from a youth theatre. And again, the core team needs to be local, needs to know the local environment, needs to be able to put people in touch with local services, and also needs to be consistent, reliable, and stay. These families have chaotic lives. They often meet one social worker after another. So having the same team based locally who will stay for years. Some families stay in the workshop for years. It's an open workshop, so they can come and go if they need it. It's voluntary. So there's no role taking, although, of course, we do have data about how many families attend, etc. But there's no sense that they're being judged, watched, evaluated, punished. All of those things that they've had a huge experience of, labeled, all of those things that are very difficult for them, they're all absent in this work. So the workers act like friendly friends or friendly neighbors, but they leave their professions outside the door, though of course the knowledge is really, really important. But when they're in the workshop, it's non-hierarchical.
So it's a really very sort of systemic approach, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's based really, on systemic work.
Yeah. You know, gosh, I've so many questions for you, don't know. but first of all, I suppose what I'm thinking is the power of a curious mind. And that psychiatrist, I think you said earlier to me, Dr. Alan Coutlin, is that his name?
Coutlin, Coutlin.
I mean, just the power of his curiosity and wondering about what was happening with these families and what were their children doing when he was treating their parents. It's just fascinating where a bit of curiosity can take us. So, you know, all fair dues to him.
Yes, and also because the model is so radically different from the existing model, he had to fight many, many battles to bring the charity to where it is now and be a radical. You know, it was not an easy journey.
So tell me a bit about that. What might the resistance be to a systemic, family-focused approach to mental health issues? Why would anybody resist that?
I think if you're a systemic therapist, there's no resistance because the family come to a family therapist for family therapy. But I think when you're taking that outside of that context and you're building a model on those principles, you're coming up against role definitions where adult psychiatrists say the children are not my responsibility. So you're also coming up against a fear. We find that many professionals don't want to talk about mental illness openly, and they fear insulting the parent by implying that they're not good parents. Schools, teachers fear opening up something they're not going to be able to follow up. Other kinds of resistances are no funding. There's very little funding for prevention work. It's most of the funding, at least in the UK, goes towards acute services and crisis management in local authorities.
That would be the same here, yeah.
Yeah. You'll find that it's very hard to get a hearing because there is such pressure on professionals. Also, you're asking people to leave aside their role authority, and you're asking them to speak on an equal level with people who are previously patients. So the relationship, the power relationship, is upended and the families are in charge.
Sorry to interrupt. I've just got too many questions for you. So when you're recruiting staff for this, you know, radical, as you described it, radical, innovative way of working, where people have to leave aside their titled profession, not the knowledge and the skills that they have, and where there isn't an authoritarian approach, how do you factor that into your recruitment? How do you know this person's going to be a good fit?
It always comes down to people. And I've learned this in my consulting career in big organizations. If you see something good happening, you'll always find somebody doing it, one person, and other people are attracted to that. So in local areas, it's much more than recruiting a team. It's actually getting somebody in that local area who is interested in the work and who wants to a different kind of way of dealing with families who they're looking at these families and thinking they need help now. They're going to get to crisis point, but I'd like to prevent them from getting to crisis point. So you will always have people who are motivated to intervene early and who are respectful of the families despite their difficulties. And when we're recruiting, we set up a network in a local area, and we send out messages through expressions of interest through the local authority, family therapists, CAMHS workers, social workers, and say, this is the kind of thing we're thinking of doing. Are you interested? So we act like a kind of magnet to say, this is a new way of helping families. Are you interested? And we get amazing people who are really committed, who really stay, sponsor the work, do far more than they're expected to do and far more hours than they're expected. But interestingly, we have a lot of social workers coming to us saying, this is the first time I felt like I was doing something other than filling in forms and telling people what wasn't available. So they come back to us and said, it's motivated me. I feel it's renewed my love of my work. And so, you know, this is amazing. Local authorities find it very hard to hold on to social workers. And so if you can both help the families to manage their very difficult circumstances and you can keep your social workers, it's a win-win.
Let's go back a minute. So one of the things that you said at the outset that the founder of Our Time was curious about was the long-term impact on children of living with a parent with a mental health issue. So maybe just tell us a bit about what those long-term implications are if there isn't this kind of intervention.
Yeah, without support, they're three times more likely to have a mental illness as they get older. And there are about, in the UK, 4 million children who live with parents with mental illness. And we know that the implications of that is that they will probably be caring for a parent. They will be anxious about that parent's health and well-being. They will often support that parent, you know, to their own detriment by staying home from school. They often get punished at school because they're late. They don't attend regularly. They don't have their homework done. They don't have their gym kit. So all these kind of things add up to create stress upon stress. So they're stressed at home because they're worried about their parents. They're tired because often the parents don't sleep well. They're often in charge of their parents' medication, which puts an enormous responsibility on their shoulders. The oldest often looks after the siblings. So they become anxious, stressed. They tend to drop out of school because they just can't manage the number of responsibilities they have. So in the long term, their schooling suffers, their ability to focus, to concentrate, because their mind is elsewhere. And we know from the ACE research that if you're in fight mode or you're very anxious, that you are not able to learn. And we know that brain architecture changes with stress. So we're talking about toxic stress, which means that it's persistent and it's something that they cannot mitigate themselves. Okay. There are very serious long-term, not just physical impact, not just mental impact, but physical impact on their long-term health.
And I suppose this is kind of the area of adverse childhood experiences, isn't it? So I think having a parent...
Yeah, it's one of the 10 adverse experiences. Of course, it's at the root of many more. It's at the root of domestic violence, of separated parents. Over 80% of our families are single parent families.
So that brings probably issues around poverty as well.
Huge relationship between poverty, social deprivation, isolation, exclusion, added to the stigma of mental health. And of course, we know that mental health doesn't arise out of nowhere, that it is related to the stresses of debt, poverty, racism. All of those things contribute to mental health problems. We often have families and children saying to us, is it genetic? Will I inevitably be ill if my parents are ill? And we know from research that it is absolutely not genetic, that the environment makes an enormous difference. And the environment is the only thing we can change. So, you know, if we can reduce the stress on the family and we can reduce the stress on the children, we can reduce the likelihood that genetic vulnerability will be manifest.
You're listening to Perspectives on Prevention. To subscribe to our podcast, go to Nearcast, Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And so tell me about the changes that you see in the families that use your service, who come to the monthly workshops that you've described. What have the outcomes been?
Oh, they're enormous, enormous. We have a pile of case studies from families. I'll just give you examples. So we find that when the parents come into the workshops, that they feel that by virtue of the fact that they have a mental illness, that they're a bad parent, and that it is not possible to talk to the children about their illness, and that they're protecting them by not talking to them. So one of the changes we see is that the parents become more confident in their role as a parent, and more confident that they can bring up a family in the way that they want to, and that the mental health is not a sort of life sentence, and it can be talked about and it can be prepared for. So, for instance, when a parent is in a good state, in a good area of their health, then they can plan for the bad times together as a family. And it's a massive relief for the family to pull together and talk openly. So one of the things we see is that the parents and the children coming back to us and saying, as they left the workshop and they were on the bus going home, it was the first time they ever talked about the illness. And a mother said to me, I looked at my children and I didn't recognize them. And I said, why not? And she said, because they were happy. And so watching the children play, when they come into the workshop, the children are often very withdrawn. They find it very difficult to be in a group. And they often sit in a corner with their phone or iPad and really find it hard to play. And by 3 to 4 months, I would go into the same workshop and I'd see these kids running around with a microphone, interviewing each other, playing the director in the film. Just a completely different sense of lightness, as if the burden had been taken away. And I'm thinking of one particular parent. I mean, we have such amazing stories. One parent who was severely traumatized herself and had stopped speaking and so had her child. So her child was about eight, her daughter, and neither of them spoke. The child didn't speak at school. And sometime into the workshop, maybe a year into the workshop, the mother said in one of the, surprisingly, in one of the open sessions, "I think I need to talk to my children more." And the child was playing in another side of the room in a very big gym hall. And he came running over and he said, "Yes, do talk." And that was the first time he'd spoken in the workshop.
Wow.
So things like that happen gradually. It goes back and forth. So it's not a trajectory all in the one direction. Families get into difficult situations. They get stressed. The parent gets taken into hospital sometimes. It's not a straight line. It's a what we have is a containment, a net to hold the family and to help them to talk to each other, to share the difficulties, to prepare for the future, to help the parents to let go of the children. Very often, the attachment between the parents and the children is very disrupted. So it's either very, very close, where the child doesn't want to leave the parent and the parent doesn't want to let the child go. And so one of the changes we see is where that becomes possible, you know, healthy separation becomes possible and the child begins to feel that they have a future of their own and that they can achieve things in life and they can have a separate mind. That's really, really important, where the child begins to have thoughts of their own, which are not the same thoughts as their parents. And, you know, you'll find that families like this are often very paranoid that the world is against them or the neighbours don't like them or the school is against their child. And when you release the child to be able to say to the parent, "No, my teacher is actually very supportive," or "I really like school, Mum, I want to go." These are small things, but they're big breakthroughs in terms of psychological separation.
I'm struck listening to you speak about the communication between parent and child. I'm struck by the similarity of the kind of discussions that we have with families where a parent's in prison.
Yes.
So we've done quite a lot of work with families impacted by prison. And, you know, in the same way that people don't like talking about mental health difficulties, parents often find quite elaborate ways of explaining, you know, where dad or big brother is. And of course, you know, the children know all along. And so it's the children have this double burden that they're carrying. So it seems like quite a similar kind of dynamic here.
Very similar, so, very similar.
Yeah. The parents' workshops, you mentioned that they're peer-led.
Okay. So a peer-led approach is important because we are trying to counteract the social isolation that these parents have. They, generally speaking, don't form supportive relationships either inside their extended family or outside in the community. So we try to build their capacity to help one another and to have some sense that they are useful and that they have their own wisdom and that their experience is useful to other people. So we're building a sense of self-confidence and we're also building a community of people who, for instance, it's very nice to see them leave the workshop and exchange numbers or email so that they can help each other out, you know, if they're late and they need their children picked up from school. Those bonds don't exist in a lot of these families. Of course, the workshop, that part of the workshop is led by a mental health professional. So there are difficult questions often around homework, discipline, bringing new partners into the family. All of these things come up and it's facilitated and modulated by somebody who has experience of facilitating difficult conversations and making sure that one parent doesn't dominate or making sure that if there's a parent who's, say, in a manic state, that doesn't dominate the group. The idea is that they help one another out in their parenting. So that part of the workshop is about their parenting. It's not about their home life or their relationships, or it's not therapy. It's how do I parent my children in the way that I want to, given that I have these challenges and given that sometimes I don't feel like getting up in the morning. It's specifically about asking the question, how can I parent well?
What's the answer to that? I mean, if I'm thinking about, you know, families that I'm sure, you know, lots of our PEN members are working with, where, you know, family life is chaotic and disrupted, and you know, children are taking a lot of the responsibility for the things that maybe, you know, ordinarily a parent might do. If mum or dad, mum, I'm thinking more likely, is saying, I can't get up in the morning, you know, I haven't got the concentration to help them with their homework or have the dinner ready. How do we manage the priority in that? What's the most important piece for the staff there? Is it about what's in the interest of the child or supporting the parent? That's quite, I'm only thinking it's a dilemma, isn't it?
It's a mixture. It's not an easy one. The intervention is directed at supporting the children's resilience and helping the children. And it's a collaboration between the team and the parents. How do we help these children to thrive? And so we're not there to fix the family, and we're not there to fix the illness, and we're not there to provide therapy. We're there to help the family to find a language in which they can think about their own situation, to develop those relationships within the family between the parent and the child, where there's more trust and there's more openness. And this helps the child very much to manage the stress of the illness. So we're not going to prevent the parent from being asleep all day, but we are going to enable the child to think about the fact that that's not because the parent doesn't love them or doesn't just want to get up. We're talking about having a mindset in which you understand that that's an illness and that the parent is not in a good way at the moment. So it removes that responsibility that the children often feel like, you know, is my parent ignoring me because I'm bad, or have I done something wrong? And it creates that kind of safe space between the parent and the child, where the child can see what's going on without feeling they have to fix it, because they can't. And it helps them to talk to their parents. You know, I'm thinking of kids who said to me, I just said to my mum, you're not well at the moment. Or mum, have you stopped taking your pills? Or maybe I should go and stay with my auntie now. So we're talking about having strategies to manage the situation. And we're talking about those strategies being a collective rather than an individual effort. So opening up the conversation, being able to talk about the illness, the child feeling like they're not responsible, the child feeling able to ask for help. Right now, without support, the children don't ask for help because they're, A, don't know what they need. And secondly, they don't know how to describe their home situation without bringing on interventions that might just break up the family and put them into care. So if you can open up that conversation where you can say to the child, or you can help the child to think, who are the people in my sort of immediate environment that I can trust, that I could talk to, who might help if things get bad? There's often a family member, sometimes a grandmother, sometimes an auntie. A kid told me one day it was somebody downstairs in the block of flats who posted books through the letterbox. And this kid knew that somebody else knew what was going on in the family, and it was an enormous support. Other times people say to me, it was my English teacher.
What would you advise to practitioners who don't have a service, as far as I'm aware, in Ireland, that does something like the TIME programme? But obviously we have families that where mental health issues are, you know, really problematic for people. So, I mean, if I'm a practitioner, if I'm a school teacher or a youth worker or working in an earlier service, and I have a sense that things aren't going well, there's maybe disruption with the child, or as you said earlier, you know, absenteeism, what would you advise somebody to do in that situation?
I think the big answer is that local authorities need to put something in place for these families. It doesn't make any sense morally or economically to ignore them, because they're going to deteriorate, and it's going to create an intergenerational cycle, which is, you know, the cost and the human cost of letting that happen is just wrong. And that means that local authorities need to put money aside for prevention, and they need to think whole family rather than interventions that are directed at the individual, either the adult or the child, because those don't work. And we know they don't work. They're short-term solutions. If you're an individual therapist, family therapist or social worker, there is very little you can do except to help the family to open up in the family. Go to our website. It's freely available. You can get it in Ireland. Look at those little films, animations, sit down with the family, play one of the short films or an animation and say, you know, do you relate to this? Because you can't just pounce on a family and say, do you think you have a mental illness and it impacts your children? So you have to be sensitive and thoughtful about how you open up the conversation. But you will never get anywhere unless you do open up the conversation. And that's the conversation between the professional and the parent, but it's also the conversation between the parents and the children. The main thing is to listen. Ask questions, be curious, listen, try and find them doing something right, build on their capacity to love one another. It often strikes me when I'm in a Kids Time workshop, when I visit a Kids Time workshop, the triumph of getting people there, the fact that they turn up, the fact that they leave home on a wet Friday evening in winter, bring all the children out on a bus and come to a workshop. I mean, it's amazing.
We're not used to talking about mental ill health. It is something that remains largely hidden and certainly stigmatizing. So what would you advise for us as professionals in order for us to be more at ease with those uncomfortable conversations?
I think you have to be at ease among yourselves first. So this topic is never at conferences. It's never in the practice papers. You'd never, ever see it. And an 8-year-old child in the school said to me recently, we were talking about stigma. And she said, it's you adults that have the stigma and we catch it from you. So wow. I think we need to talk to each other about this. We need to feel more at ease ourselves with thinking about it. And that will change, I think. I mean, one of the reasons that Joe Wicks' documentary is so good and the podcasts work and this one works is it starts to build a conversation that isn't happening and break the silence.
One last question, Dimna. The drama focus for the children, I'm reminded of a long time ago, I worked with early school leavers and we did a drama program with this amazing guy, Darren Chan. And it was just one of the most uplifting things I've ever been involved in. But we hadn't anticipated having a show at the end of it. It was a kind of 6-week project or something. Anyway, we ended up having a show. And actually, what I realized afterwards, for the young people, if we hadn't done that, something really important would have been missing for them. I'm wondering how important is it for the children at the Kids Town workshops to do their DVD to, you know, it's because to me, that's a bit about having an achievement and a product. Do you see that as an important part of it?
We do. We see it as it's crucially important. It allows the children to be in another character. And it gives them a voice in which they're not afraid or ashamed. And it's very funny when you see a 6-year-old playing a psychiatrist or a social worker, it's hilariously funny. You're dealing with something really difficult and sensitive, but you're doing it with humor and lightness. And then what you're talking about in terms of having a product, when we show it back to the parents at the end and we have pizza, so we sort of break bread together and have a movie, and it's their movie. And the parents are so proud of their kids for having done this. And they also say, gosh, I never knew how much my children knew about my illness. I thought I'd protected them. So that very easy way of breaking a taboo where the parents suddenly realize I'm not protecting them by being quiet about this. They know anyway. If a professional said that to them, they wouldn't listen because they'd feel it as a judgment about them. But in the little videos, it's there on screen. The children love doing the videos, absolutely love it. So they have such fun.
I can imagine. Yeah, Yeah.
And that's the playing thing that's so important for kids, to let them play.
Well, Dimna, thank you so much. I mean, I'm really fascinated, and I'm going to dig deeper into your website, ourtime.org, because I really think that there are lots of families and services that would benefit from some of the wisdom that you've gleaned. And I'm sure you and lots of other people are ever grateful to Dr. Alan Coutlin for his curious mind. And I think, you know, we need to just keep talking. So thank you for helping us in that conversation.
It's great pleasure. And just let's not forget that we can do this in schools. We can open up a conversation in schools, primary and secondary. And there, we don't have to wait for the whole family to turn up. The children are there anyway. Easiest way to start the conversation is to, if you look at our website and you look at our PSHE lessons, you'll see that there's a ready-made solution to putting it into schools. We can do that right now with very little cost.
Thanks, Dimna. Lovely to meet you.
Great pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to Perspectives on Prevention. We hope we've inspired you and given you something to think about. If you want to suggest someone for us to chat with, we'd love to hear from you. Just drop us an email at info@pein.ie.